Hello, I'm Dave Rosen. This is number 0510, the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, and it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there! Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File program, number 0510. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File program, former boxer Jerry Cooney, who is the author of Gentleman Jerry, a contender in the ring, a champion in recovery. He followed his brother into boxing.
My father was a big drinker and very angry man, and he took it out on most of the kids. And my older brother left the house at 15, so when around 18, he started going to a gym that wasn't far from where I lived. So I used to follow him there for a couple of days a week, and then I started punching the bag, and I felt good. I liked it, and then I started boxing. I won the New York State Golden Glove Championship after 6 months of boxing in Madison Square Garden in 1973.
Digital forensic investigator Brian Samrow talks about computer security.
The problem with personal information is a lot of people use the same password across everything. So if somebody's able to successfully social engineer you with one account, chances are they can get into a lot of other accounts as well. And so the more information that you have out there, just the general rule of thumb is the more somebody could target you specifically. It's getting to the point where, yes, a lot of times we see this in a corporate environment, but we also see it in a personal environment as well.
Stuart Nullman is in with another edition of Book Banter.
Hi, I'm Stuart Nullman. And Book Banter asks the question, what do you get when you put together the Marx Brothers and Salvador Dali? You end up with giraffes on horseback salad. That all comes alive in its surrealistic glory later on the Stuff File program.
And there's lots and lots of Stuff File news and, of course, an idiot of the day. The guest Slater, the person who told you this was show number 0510, was Dave Rosen, who is a comic, a broadcaster, a movie buff, and a poster collector. You can check out some of his stuff at posteropolis.com. And, of course, you can go to the Stuff File webpage, which is thestufffile.com. Go to the show for this number, which is 0510, which you just heard Dave say. See how it all goes around full circle? And you'll find the link to David's site. Thank you very much, Dave, for doing the guest slate on this edition of the Stuff File program, a show that is listener-supported, fan-funded radio that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com, like new patron Jerry Bradley. Thank you very much, Jerry. Much appreciated. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Well, let's get right to the stuff, shall we? 58-year-old Jennifer G. Hernandez is nothing if not persistent. On April 22nd, Hernandez walked through the vehicle gate at CIA headquarters in Langley, Virginia, where she was stopped by a police officer. She explained that she had an interview in the complex, but the officer discovered she had no official business there and told her to leave. On May the 1st, Hernandez returned, this time in a Lyft vehicle, again asking to see her recruiter. She was issued a written warning and directed to leave. On May the 2nd, she was back, in an Uber this time, telling officers she returned because the recruiter's phone was off. On that day, officers inadvertently kept her North Carolina ID card, so on May the 3rd, she came back to pick it up and also asked if she could speak to Agent Penis. Oh, dear Lord, I hope his first name wasn't Richard. Promising to leave by bus, Hernandez ultimately refused, telling an officer, "Do you really think I'm going to leave?" And that's when they'd had enough. Hernandez was arrested and charged with trespassing. Did they even check to see if there was an Agent Penis at the CIA? Just asking. Okay, nobody likes spiders. But which would you like less, dealing with a spider in your lap or losing your vehicle in a river? For one Georgia woman, the choice was easy. The woman told a state trooper she was trying to back her Kia van down a boat launch on the Etowah River to put her kayak in the water when a spider jumped in on her lap. Naturally, she jumped out of the van. The van then rolled into the river. Georgia State Patrol sent a trooper to the boat launch, but by the time the trooper arrived, the van had long slipped out of sight. She stated that it floated downstream a few feet, a GSP spokesman said, and within seconds, it was totally submerged. The woman's insurance company will foot the bill for a dive team to locate the van and tow it out of the river. Well, that's a new one. Bet you won't see that in an insurance commercial.
We know a thing or two because we've seen a thing or two.
We are farmers. Bum, 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 bum.
Well, then again, maybe. The bell tolls for someone. Time for the Darwin File.
I am the Grim Reaper. I am death.
Here's something we never had on the show before, a twofer in the same program. Two stories for the price of one. Here's the first one. Two Texas men died after they tried to jump over an open drawbridge with their car. Louisiana State Police responded to a single car crash shortly after 2 a.m. at the Black Bayou Bridge about 6 miles south of Lake Charles. The bridge was closed to traffic to let a boat pass. A witness told police that the passenger got out of the car and pushed the gate arm up. The man then got back into the car as the driver drove toward the ramp at the end of the bridge. The driver stopped briefly, reversed, and then accelerated forward in an attempt to jump the ramp of the bridge. The car landed in the water and sank to the bottom. The driver was found inside the car, and the passenger was found outside the vehicle after first managing to escape. The men were pronounced dead at the scene. You know, this never happened to the Duke boys or the Bandit, although I do remember that it did happen to Smokey, but both he and his idiot son survived. Still, the tree of life is often self-pruning. And you know, sometimes people die for a reason. Maybe they are a soldier, or maybe they overdose on drugs. Some people just get sick and die for no reason at all. Then there are the people who get run over while doing push-ups, naked, in the street. The unfortunate fitness enthusiast was 43-year-old James Earl Hunter of Oregon. Portland police were called to a report of a man running naked in traffic at 4 a.m. As officers responded, a second report came in that the naked man was doing push-ups in the street, then a third report that he'd been struck by a vehicle. Officers and emergency medical workers found the man deceased. The driver of the vehicle that struck the man remained at the scene and was cooperative. According to police, the driver was not impaired by alcohol or drugs. But I'm sure he needs a drink now. Why would someone do naked push-ups in the middle of the street at 4 a.m.? We may never know, but once again, the tree of life is often self-proving.
I have come for you.
Anyway, let's get to our first guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? Boxer Jerry Cooney, known as Gentleman Jerry, fought some spectacular bouts beginning in the 70s. He's sharing his story in a book he co-wrote called Gentleman Jerry, A Contender in the Ring, and Jerry joins us on the line right now from New Jersey. Hi, Jerry.
How's it going? Nice to have you. Also, the bottom line is a champion in recovery. But, in my life, I had an addiction problem. I got addicted to alcohol like most Irish, Canadian, well, at least I did. And I got so put the drink down April 21st, 1988. I just celebrated 31 years without a drink.
Congratulations. Congratulations, sir.
Thank you.
Now, your father encouraged you to get into boxing. Your brother was a boxer. Did you really have any choice in the matter?
You know what? My brother left the house when he was 15. My father was a big drinker and very angry man, and he took it out on most of the kids. And my older brother left the house at 15. So when around 18, he started going to a gym that wasn't far from where I lived. So I used to follow him there for a couple of days a week and hang out with him. And then I started punching the bag, and I felt good. I liked it. And then I started boxing, and I won the New York State Golden Glove Championship after 6 months of boxing at in Madison Square Garden in 1973.
So this obviously, I would guess, brought attention to the boxing pros to how you developed as a boxer. When did you first started getting recognition for your boxing prowess? When you were an amateur?
Well, I mean, when I was 16, I fought in the middleweight championship, which is the largest tournament in the United States. And I had 7 fights. I had 5 knockouts to win the middleweight championship that year in 1973. And then my ticket was made. I loved what they did to me. See, boxing at home, I kind of, out of sight, out of mind, I wouldn't get hurt. But boxing helped me by putting my picture in the paper, and also it helped me express the anger I felt for what was going on in my house.
Which brings me to the name Gentleman Jerry. Everyone knows you as Gentleman Jerry. Where did that term first come from and why?
You know, I had a friend, a man I worked for when I was 17, and he knew I was a boxer, and I reminded him of Gentleman Jim Corbett. And he gave me that name when I was 17, and it kind of stuck. And listen, I love people. I work with kids. I work with people trying to help them make the connection to the next place in their lives. I never had that. I had to find my own way. At 17, I left the home and I lived on my own. And I, you know, kicked and scratched and found my way. Met this guy and talked to that guy and this guy. And I became a professional fighter. And so I try and help those less fortunate today whenever I can and every day to find what's next for them.
You mentioned that you, as a young man, were angry. You got into boxing. Did boxing focus your anger? In other words, what do you think you would be or who you would be if you didn't get into boxing?
You know, it was like when I was 17 and most of my friends were going away to college, I knew I wasn't going to college. And so boxing was the next thing that fit me. And I needed to find how am I going to have a family, to raise, buy a house, to support kids, and boxing fed that for me. I fought on the United States team. I fought in Europe. I knocked out the third-ranked Russian heavyweight in 1975. And so I got invited to the finals of the Olympic trials, which I didn't go to because I lacked the self-esteem. I felt I wasn't good enough. I was going to not look good. And I didn't go. And it's one of the biggest regrets of my life that I didn't take the shot at the 1976 Olympics. And then my father passed, and I turned pro 6 or 8 months later.
You see, you could have come here to Montreal because that's where the Olympics were in 1976.
You know, I love Canada. I'm in Canada all the time. Steve Guérant is a good friend of mine up in Ottawa. We do a big fight night there every year. And listen, I'm Canadian. I got to get up to St. John's, Newfoundland to see where my family lived growing up.
Now, around the time that you were in boxing, especially when you were coming up, there was a lot of, shall we say, racial tension. Did you get in, were you aware of what was going on? And was that playing into the fact that you were a white boxer because, you know, someone was looking for the next great white hope kind of thing?
You know, I know that Don King, who co-promoted that fight with my manager, was trying to make money on that, a white hope. You know, white hope. And I don't know for sure, but I'm sure my managers may have had some hand in that as well. But for me, I had 5 or 6 kids I grew up with, and we went to training camp in California and Vegas, all over the country, and we had the time of our lives. I never paid attention about black and white. And listen, to me, I'm an athlete. Larry Holmes was an athlete. And the best thing that happened was all the anger that went on before there. When the referee gave us instructions, Larry Holmes looked at me and said, "Let's have a good fight." And that's what championship boxing is all about to me.
Your book, Gentleman Jerry, A Contender in the Ring, A Champion in Recovery. Why write this book now?
Well, it's a time in my life where I get to I reflected for so long, and I wanted the story to be told. It's a great story. I struggled growing up. I got from rags to riches. I stumbled. I made some mistakes. after I knocked out Kenny Norton. My career really, I knocked out Kenny Norton 1 minute of the first round. When I'm getting a shot at the title, something happened along that time where I picked up alcohol and ran with it. I don't know if it was scary, too scary for me. I don't know, but it happened, and there was my downfall. And but in 1988, I put it down. I learned about my life. I cleaned it up and have a great family. I'm on the radio. They're doing a movie on my life. I have a book coming. I have a possible television series. So listen, you do the right thing. You pick yourself off the floor. You dust your bottom off, and you keep moving forward. And that's a great story about everybody's struggle with life, finding our way, standing up for ourselves, you know, raising our hand. Can you help me? I mean, there was a period of time when that was what I heard. Someone said, can you help me? I thought, wow, that's a great thing to be able to say. And I listened to that man, and I moved forward, and I found my way. And I'm living the life today. I'm helpful to people. I love my life. I'm still relevant. And Larry Holmes and I are great friends, and that's my story.
I was about to bring up the fact of the camaraderie amongst boxers. It's a very, well, in a pugilistic situation, it's fight or lose, and there's a rivalry there. But underneath that, is there a camaraderie amongst boxers? Did you become friends with the people you actually fought against over the years?
Well, I mean, let's face it. When you have to get into the ring, I mean, I don't know the person I'm fighting. You can't like the person you're fighting, because once the bell rings, I look at it as liken it to being a gladiator. You know, he's in the corner with his sword, and I'm in the corner with my sword. When the bell rings, I got to take his head off before he takes my head off. That's just boxing. So when it's all over and said and done, you know, we have respect for each other, that we walked the walk. We got into the, we climbed up those four steps, waited for the bell to ring, and we fought it out. And that's sports, in all sports, we're nervous, we're uncomfortable until the bell rings. Once the bell rings, we get into a fight plan, we make adjustments, we figure out his flaws, and then we try and, you know, take advantage of them.
What do you think?
Go ahead.
What do you think of boxing today? Has it changed a lot since the time you were in the ring?
You know, I'm so excited about boxing today because it lost touch with a lot of people after our generation. And now it's coming back. We have The Zone. We have Bob Arum. We have ESPN. We have Showtime. We have all these different great boxing promoters. And boxing's got great talent, deep. You know, a lot of times when you're in the fight game, you got maybe three guys that can fight a little bit. Right now, the divisions are so deep with talent. Even the heavyweight division. I mean, we've got Anthony Joshua, Tyson Fury, Deontay Wilder, and six or seven other great guys coming up. The light heavyweight, the middleweight, the welterweight. So it's a great time to hook. I tell people, you know, I'm on SiriusXM 156 every Monday, every Friday from 6 to 8 p.m. on channel 156. And I tell people, on your computer face, put ESPN Boxing or Max Boxing and follow the top stories. These are great fighters, and they're going to be fighting, and we get a chance to watch them. So boxing, what's made boxing so great all these years is that back in the old days when the Depression was around and the countries were at war, Joe Louis came and fought Max Schmeling and gave America courage to fight on. And so people are struggling with two and three jobs. They can identify with a professional fighter and follow him. And it kind of, if my guy wins, I feel a little stronger the next day. If my team wins, I feel a little stronger the next day to get through the struggles of life. And that's what's so great about it. I get chills telling you, because I'm the same kind of guy as all the fans. I love boxing. I follow it. And it gives me strength.
The book is called Gentleman Jerry, A Contender in the Ring, A Champion in Recovery. Jerry Cooney, thank you very, very much for taking the time to be on the program with us.
Please, and it's fighterwriter2.com where you can get a hold and find the book, or in any bookstore coming out mid-June. And listen, love talking with you today. Anytime you want to talk fighting, please call me. I'd love to talk to you.
Great. And what's that website you just mentioned again?
It's fighterwriter2.com.
Fighterwriter2.com. Thank you very much, Jerry.
Have a great day. Appreciate your time.
Boxer Jerry Cooney. Again, the book is Gentleman Jerry, A Contender in the Ring, A Champion in Recovery. And the website he mentioned was fighterwriter2.com. That's fighterwriter2.com. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the page for this program, which is show number 0510, and you'll find links to Jerry's website and also links to either amazon.com or amazon.ca, where you can order his book directly. You're listening to The Stuff File Program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
The Stuff File Program is a listener-supported, fan-funded radio show that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Sign up and find out about our rewards program. Being a patron doesn't have to be a long-term commitment. There's absolutely no obligation. You could join today and end whenever you'd like, but the time we have your support would be so greatly appreciated. We'd also love to hear your thoughts about the show and even your ideas for rewards. Join us for the ride. Join us at patreon.com/thestufffileprogram. Here's a penny for your thoughts from the Stuff File Program, coming to you from Montreal, Canada, a country that doesn't have pennies.
And still to come in the program, we'll talk about computer security. Plus, we do indeed have another edition of Book Banter with Stuart Nullman. There is an Idiot of the Day coming your way a little later on, and much more Stuff File news here on the Stuff File program, which is heard everywhere, including on Stitcher and TuneIn, and can also be heard via Google Play and iTunes. Just click on the Google Play or iTunes button located on the website at thestufffile.com, and whichever platform you listen to the program on, feel free to leave a review of the show on their site. It would be greatly appreciated. Well, let's get back to the stuff. A convenience store robber in Brisbane, Australia, attempted to hide his identity by wearing a blue shopping bag on his head. Since the reusable bag is not transparent, he had to pull it up so that he could see. After getting cash and cigarettes at knife point, the robber needed something to help carry the loot away, so he took the bag off his head and put it to its more conventional use. The unidentified man is being sought by police. You know, I could have easily made him the idiot of the day, except for one minor point. He's still at large! How does someone get away with a crime like this? Also, he used a smokeless weapon and a reusable bag. Not many robbers are that environmentally conscious. On the other end of the environmental scale, we don't know what brought 29-year-old Kofi Castillon of Largo, Florida, to the Mies Dunedin Hospital emergency room on May 13th, but we know where she went afterward, the Pinellas County Jail. Castillon first caused a stir when she nicked 7 bathing cloths and 10 pairs of hospital slippers valued at a whopping combined price of $10.79. earning her a felony charge because of her 2 previous theft convictions. But her most grievous crime that evening was taking a used feminine pad from underneath her pants and throwing it at a healthcare provider, striking her in the stomach. For that, Castillon was charged with battery and held on $7,000 bond. I'll bet that healthcare provider went through at least a bottle and a half of Purell before the end of their shift that day. Yeah. Georgia Michelle Zawacki of West Newton Borough, Pennsylvania, celebrated her 55th birthday on May 15th by drinking vodka all day, according to her boyfriend, David Ray. They also went out to dinner to mark the occasion, but after they returned home, Zawacki became angry that there were no gifts or cards, or a cake. "Next thing you know, I'm getting stabbed," Ray said. He told Westmoreland County Police that Zawacki came at him with a box cutter. Recounted Ray, "She went to my neck. She says, I'm going to kill you." She ended up cutting his arm. Then she destroyed his bedroom, throwing his TV to the floor and breaking his bed. She was charged with aggravated assault and spent the rest of her birthday in jail. Wow. Somebody needs to be the center of attention. Eww. Are you guessing that perhaps she had some childhood birthday issues? Yeah. Still, let's show her a little love. Happy birthday, Georgia.
Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday, happy birthday. Happy birthday to you.
There you go. Now get a grip. Okay, it's the nature of technology to evolve, but not all change is good. Take the latest innovation to the Uber app. The new conversation allows riders to choose quiet preferred, happy to chat, or no preference before ordering a car. In a form for Uber drivers, some categorically decried the change as a violation of free speech, while others said determining a rider's needs can be a source of anxiety. Still, others worried about how the feature would affect their ratings. It feels like they are just turning us into robots, one driver said. This feature is telling us to just shut up and drive. And as a human being, I don't like being told how to do my job. Really? Listen, pal, unless you're self-employed and independently wealthy, then there is always someone who can tell you how to do your job. That's the nature of a job. But why am I arguing with you? Just shut up and drive. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our next guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, police in Portland, Oregon say 48-year-old Rob Stout made a bomb and left it on the back of another man's car. The bomb was in a plastic toolbox packed with dog poop. When the victim opened the toolbox, it exploded with such force that it sounded like an M80 going off and the dog scat was blown out. The explosive was the charge from an automotive airbag. No injuries were reported, but Stout was charged with unlawfully manufacturing a destructive device, which is a felony. He was also charged with drug possession, possession of a firearm by a convicted felon, and possession of a sawed-off shotgun. Stout allegedly admitted to placing the bomb because he was mad at the man, a former friend, for failing to return something of his. Well, that really is a crappy way to treat a friend, former or otherwise. But I also have to ask, would you really open a suspicious package that was left on the back of your car? Yeah. Anyway, let's get to our next guest here in this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? Brian Semrau is a digital forensic investigator. He's here to talk about computer security and also just what exactly a digital forensic investigator is. Brian joins us on the line via Skype from Chicago. Hi, Brian.
Hey.
So, off the bat, what exactly is a digital forensic investigator?
Well, at the very core of it, it's somebody who investigates something that's already happened. Specifically on something that's digital, usually a computer, a phone, something to that extent.
Okay. Now, when it comes to our security, one of the things, I mean, we hear a lot of talk about social media, for example, and that we're giving away too much information. What is the crime, first of all, in the amount of information we're giving away if we are aware that we're giving it away?
Well, it depends on the person and their risk level. For instance, I have a website out there that has a lot of my information about what I do, my background, some of my certifications, that sort of thing. And I feel that's an acceptable risk level for me. It depends on the user. A lot of times with social media, what you have to be worried about is how a threat actor could be able to use that information against you. So one of the biggest things that we see these days is social engineering is a problem. So social engineering is where somebody says, I want to get some information about you. It used to be the Nigerian print scams and stuff like that, where they would just send out these mass emails and you would get, you know, maybe one responder per, you know, every million that they sent out. But these days, what they're doing is they're making it a lot more targeted. So they'll actually do a lot of reconnaissance on whoever they're emailing first to see a little bit about them. One of my favorite examples is a company that I had done some work for had their payroll manager get an email that said, hey, you know, I need this information changed right now. And the name was spoofed to make it look like it was coming from the CEO. Now, it didn't actually have the domain's email on there, you know, so it wasn't this company's email address. But it still had his name on there. And because of it is an executive, and it had all this information about their, you know, it knew her name, who she was, that sort of thing, she responded right away, you know, and basically that did end up getting changed. We caught it before anything could happen. But, you know, it's something where they do all this research to be able to figure out who you are, what you do, and how they might be able to use that against you.
Hmm. Now, that's a situation where we're talking about on a corporate level. What about the average everyday individual user who is using various types of social media for personal use, and it's not a business situation? What do we have to concern ourselves with when it comes to our own security?
Well, you know, you have a lot of information out there that could be used against you. For instance, your social security number, passwords. The problem with personal information is a lot of people use the same password across everything. So if somebody's able to successfully social engineer you with one account, chances are they can get into a lot of other accounts as well. And so the more information that you have out there, just the general rule of thumb is the more somebody could target you specifically. It's getting to the point where, yes, a lot of times we see this in a corporate environment, but we also see it in a personal environment as well.
Okay, what about some of the things that aren't necessarily illegal or necessarily scams, but there are legal ways of getting information out of you that you might not be comfortable with? I'll give you an example. Nowadays, if you want to go to a lot of newspaper sites, before you can read a story, when you click on the link, they want to ask you a survey question first. Yeah. And it's a third-party company that's asking the survey question. Is this something that you should be or can be weary of?
Yes. It depends on what it is. For instance, if it asks you to install anything, I'd be very leery of that. A lot of the ones that I've seen, it will ask you to install, hey, can you install this application, this browser extension, etc. And when you do that, you have to be very careful about what you're installing because it can get a lot of information off your computer. So in theory, it might be able to sit there and grab all sorts of information about you as you're browsing that could be used to access your accounts directly without even social engineering you.
Browser cookies is something else that comes up a lot, especially nowadays, because laws require some companies to mention right on their front page that they are using cookies, and they say, we are using cookies, accept or deny. Mm-hmm. And sometimes people are leery to accept because they don't know if by clicking accept, something nefarious is going to happen.
Yep. Well, cookies do have a very legitimate use. For instance, authentication. When you're browsing the web, each time you click on something, the server doesn't know who you are that second time. So a cookie can be stored in your browser to identify you to the server to say, hey, this is somebody who's already logged in. So that way, every time you're clicking on something on Facebook, for instance, you don't have to sign in again. So that's a very important usage of cookies. There's a flip side, though. Because the cookies can identify you, they can also be used to track you. There's actually a website out there. I'm not going to say it because I consider it very dangerous. But what it does is it gives web developers the ability to embed plugin on their website, and it will use cookies to identify the user by name, by email address, and even sometimes by physical address at times. And it has about a 50% success rate for each visitor that visits your website. So, you know, cookies can definitely be used against you, even not necessarily on the website that you're accepting them on. But if you go to another website and they're tracking your cookies through there, if they see a Google cookie or a Facebook cookie or something like that, once it's been used enough, it can actually identify you by name.
And one of the things that always worries me about cookies is the idea that the people or the company that is doing this is usually a third party to the site I'm going to on the first place. Mm-hmm. Would it be fair to say that one could be more comfortable if the cookies were something that the site itself was doing and not a third party?
Absolutely. And here's the thing. A lot of web developers don't even think about privacy as they're really developing stuff, just because that's not what their primary focus is. Their primary focus is getting something done and getting it done quickly, making sure it works, making sure it's reliable. And one of the best ways to do that is to use third-party libraries, third-party services, and stuff like that. You know, one example that goes around the privacy community a lot, which I'm not sure I buy into the concerns about it a ton, but it's Cloudflare. And Cloudflare is a service that companies can use, which basically sits in between the user that's requesting the website and the server. And it filters out malicious requests, stuff like that. But the problem is it decrypts your traffic as you're going there. So if you're using a website and you see on the top that says HTTPS, that means it's encrypted. Because Cloudflare sits in between and it's checking all these requests that go to the server, it can sit there and it can decrypt all this information. Now, it has a very legitimate use that a web host would want to be able to use. You'd want to be able to use this on your servers. But you still have that concern of, okay, now they can see all my information, including all my passwords that I'm submitting to my site, all of this. And again, I'm not nothing against Cloudflare specifically. There's also Akamai. There's also all these other versions of Cloudflare. Cloudflare just happens to be one of the most popular ones.
When it comes to concerns about privacy and security, is it a situation that's getting better or getting worse as time goes on? In other words, we read about it, we hear about it, but is that the hype or the actuality in that it is a growing concern?
It's a growing concern. I would say it's getting better in terms of awareness, especially when it comes to security. I think we are making some very important strides in security compared to where we were, say, 10 years ago. There's so much that we've fixed. There's so much that we've built into our security practices that we've been able to increase on that. And privacy on the other side, I think we're still in the infancy of being able to say that it's getting better. It's getting better simply because more people are thinking about it. The problem is it's a very confusing topic.
There was a time back in the day when everyone would say, oh, you know, there's got to be a concern about malware on PCs. There's got to be a concern about viruses on PCs. But people who have Macs don't have that problem. Is that still true or is that a fallacy?
Oh, that is a fallacy. The big thing that's out there, and any Mac fanatic will probably say, is, well, Macs don't get viruses. You know, viruses are different than malware. And to be fair, they are. I am somebody who nitpicks about the differences between viruses, malware. Viruses are malware, but viruses, trojans, adware, that sort of thing. The thing to keep in mind is viruses have not really been prevalent in recent years at all. And what I mean by virus is it's a malware piece of malware that replicates by infecting other executable files on your computer. And so it would basically spread when somebody copied an infected file from one computer to another, normally by a flash drive, floppy drive, something like that. So it's just not the most responsible way, so to speak, from a malware developer's perspective. There's so many more efficient ways to be able to spread your malware than it is to write a virus. And it's not easy to write a new virus either. You know, you have to be able to build it so that it injects the code into these other files while still being able to have these other files work. Malware, just a general term, meaning anything that's malicious, and I would even include potentially unwanted programs, you know, stuff that might have a legitimate purpose, but in reality is mostly malicious. Those are very prevalent on anything, whether it's Mac, whether it's Windows, anything like that. The only one that I really haven't seen it on too much is Linux. And that's simply because the majority of Linux users are geeks who are a little bit more aware of what they're doing, and those that aren't are very few. So it just doesn't make sense for malware developers to be writing this type of stuff when there's a low chance of them being able to actually infect a Linux machine.
And it's also based on numbers, too. I mean, when we were talking about the back in the day when everyone said, oh, beware of PCs, it's because PCs were prevalent.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it wasn't worth going after Macs because there weren't as many of them. I guess you could say the same thing about Linux today. It's just not worth going after.
Well, and I would, the one thing I would say about Linux not being worth going after, I think it is worth going after because it's used in corporate environments. It runs the majority of the internet, right? It's just that it's going to be harder to convince a Linux admin to install malware on a computer than it is going to be somebody else. Now, there is ransomware. There is stuff like that out there for Linux, especially via the SMB1 vulnerabilities and stuff like that, where it was able to automatically spread without user input. But for the most part, there is less of a user base that is actually actively using Linux as a desktop operating system. So the numbers just aren't there. And really, at that point, it comes down to security through obscurity. And security through obscurity just isn't security.
Well, this has been a lovely bedtime story. if people want to get in contact with you, how can they reach you, sir?
InfoSec Chicago. That's InfoSecChicago.com. That's my business website. I do security consulting, some forensic services as well through there. It has my contact information and my phone number and all that on there.
Brian, thank you very much for being on the program with us.
Thank you.
Digital forensic investigator Brian Semrau. Again, you can check out his website at infosecchicago.com. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, check out the show number for this program, which is show number 0510, and you'll find links to Brian's page. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
Got something for the mailbag? Send your email to mailbag@thestufffile.com. And remember, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H. That's mailbag@thestufffile.com. Stick around. There's more Stuff File coming your way in a moment.
Peter Anthony Holder here. Often I mention my book, Great Conversations, My Interviews with Two Men on the Moon and a Galaxy of Stars. I also often mention that I'd like you to become a patron of the Stuff File program via Patreon.com. Well, this is my opportunity to combine both of those pleas to you. You've heard me say on many occasions about the myriad of celebrities I've had the chance to talk to that are contained in my book, which is published by Bear Manor Media. You've also heard me mention that some of the celebrities in my book, and many others, can be heard on our page at Patreon.com. Well, if you've been on the fence about joining Patreon, let me try to pull you over to our side. By becoming a patron, you help to make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. And if you do become a regular patron, as a Patreon reward, I'll share with you an electronic version of my book for your e-reader. So join Patreon and claim your copy of Great Conversations, My Interviews with Two Men on the Moon and a Galaxy of Stars. Sign up today at patreon.com/thestufffileprogram.
Latitude 47 degrees 14 minutes north. Longitude 84 degrees 39 minutes west. Location Montreal, Canada. This is the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. It's time to crack a spine. The Stuff File presents Book Banter with Stuart Nauman. Once again, here's Peter Anthony Holder.
And here he is to answer that age-old question, how an elephant got into his pants. It's Stuart Nauman. Hi, Stu.
Hi, Peter. Well, you know who, can answer that? Captain Jeffrey T. Spaulding. You remember what the T stood for?
What does the T stand for in Jeffrey T. Spaulding?
Well, it stood for Edgar.
Ah, okay. Of course.
Yeah. You'd have to see Animal Crackers to appreciate that one.
And since we have brought up the Marx Brothers on more than one occasion in this short, brief introduction, that means we're going to touch on the Marx Brothers in one way, shape, or form with this week's book. Enlighten us.
That's right.
Enlighten us, Stuart. Enlighten us.
Enlighten? Well, I got the light on now, so how's that?
Very good.
Chico would have loved that one. But, just when I thought, Peter, I have read practically every book by or about my all-time favorite movie comedians, the Marx Brothers, another new volume surfaces that deals with the life of or comedy of that madcap brotherly foursome or threesome. And this time, this new book is a graphic novel that it's of an actual script for a potential Marx Brothers movie that never made it to the screen. And the script did not come
from a guest that we had on this very program.
That's right. You got it.
Yes.
You got it. And basically, that script did not come from the typewriter of a well-known or budding comedy writer. It came from the mind of one of the greatest surrealist artists of the 20th century, Salvador Dali. And the coming together of a surrealist artist and a trio of anarchistic comedians had its genesis back in 1936 when Dali first met Harpo during a party in Paris, France, not Paris, Iowa. Struck up a friendship, and then the following year, Dali made a trip to Hollywood where he paid a visit to Harpo's home and spent some time with the beloved comedian, as Dali told him of this idea of a surrealistic style movie that would star the Marx Brothers.
So you said it's not Paris, Iowa?
No, it's Paris, France.
How about Paris, Texas?
Not even there.
Paris, Ontario?
Not even close.
Okay.
Well, Harpo arranged a pitch meeting between MGM, their big boss Louis B. Mayer, and Dali about the possibility of having this studio where the Marx's previous two comedies were box office hits for MGM, turn the idea into a major motion picture. So Dali had a 14-page treatment about this potential movie, but Mayer flat out rejected it, stating that Daly was an unknown in Hollywood and MGM would not take the gamble of producing a movie with such an unusual premise. I mean, even Groucho echoed Mayer's sentiments about this Daly-esque starring vehicle, saying quite simply, and I quote, "It won't play."
Gee, if Groucho had gone along with it, he could have simply said, "Hello, Daly."
Yeah, he could have. No, Chico probably would have done that one, but it won't play. I mean, not even Peoria. Wouldn't even play in Peoria, I guess.
No.
So what happened was the project was shelved. Just an interesting footnote in the history of the Marx Brothers. However, more than 80 years later, Marx Brothers fans in general, and classic movie buffs in particular, thanks to the tireless efforts of Josh Frank, who was on your program, and the pen of illustrator Manuela Pertega, we finally get to see how this bizarre combination of comedy and art materializes if MGM greenlighted the project back in 1937. And the end result is this intriguing graphic novel called Giraffes on Horseback Salad. But you won't see any giraffes in it, and there's nothing culinary about in it either. No salad dealing with horseback riding. No. This is a story that takes place in New York City, circa 1937, and it focuses on Jimmy, a successful businessman who lives in a black and white world, drowns in a sea of paperwork, and has to deal with Linda, his mean, vulgar, snobbish social climber of a girlfriend. Now, during a rather ritzy party, Jimmy has a chance encounter with an unusual female called the Surrealist Woman, a mysterious chameleon-like individual who quickly catches his attention, not to mention his affection. Jimmy realizes that the Surrealist Woman is indeed the girl of his dreams. However, the force of normalcy, in the form of a very jealous Linda, tries to block the hooking up of the pair, but it's up to the efforts of Groucho and Chico to make sure that she and Jimmy become lovers in order for him to find true happiness.
Romantics at heart.
Yeah, so I never knew the Marx Brothers. I mean, they knew them to be troublemakers, not matchmakers, actually.
Yes.
But whoever reads the graphic novel portion of this book may understandably scratch their heads in a state of confusion of what the story of Giraffes is all about and how it's presented. But in order to appreciate it further, one must take into account that this story is from the mind of Salvador Dali. And it looks like a combination of A Night at the Opera and The Beatles' Yellow Submarine. And Giraffes on Horseback Salad looks like a movie scenario that would have made it to the screen had it been produced 30 years later at the height of the psychedelic period. And thanks to Josh Frank's diligent efforts to tell the full story of this rarely heard piece of the Marx Brothers story, we get a fascinating, well-rounded history behind Salvador Dali's quest to break into the movie industry and the lengths it took to have this long-buried story resurrected to satisfy the never-ending quest for little-known facts and stories by future generations of classic film buffs.
Now, Stuart, I know you are the world's biggest Marx Brothers fan, and
yes,
you are also a major Marx Brother collector.
Yes.
So having said that, where does this book, Giraffes on Horseback Salad, fit into your canon of Marx Brothers memorabilia that you so covet?
Well, it ranks high up there. I mean, I'd say in the 7 or 8 level. Because I know that in past other books about the brothers and illustrated, especially Groucho's illustrated autobiography, The Groucho File, there is mention made of what Salvador Dali wanted to do with this project, and even pictures of Dali's, when Harpo, he's doing a sketch of Harpo, and one of those sketches that he did of Harpo Marx, and the gift that Dali gave Harpo of a unusual harp with the strings made of a barbed wire. So it's, like I said, we only knew this in passing that Salvador Dali had an interest doing something with the brothers. We didn't know all the meat of the story. Now we know the meat of this story. And I wish that hopefully maybe Josh Frank will do something about, that's use that same diligent effort about, the Dali Marx could have been to what happened to the Marx Brothers' first movie, Humorisk, which was a silent movie that they did in 1920, yet no copies of it exist anymore. So maybe that's another project for Josh to embark upon.
Maybe I'll give him a call.
Yeah. But you know what? Let's get back to this Dali and the Salvador Dali project. I just want to say that this book, Giraffes on Horseback Salad, is a wonderful piece of unearthed Hollywood hidden history. We get that rare opportunity to experience what could have been had two sets of unconventional artistic minds would not have been regarded by the real world, as way ahead of their time.
Wow. Again, the book is?
called Drafts on Horseback Salad by Josh Frank and Manuela Pertega. It's published by Court Books, and it's $34.99.
And in that genre, what else do you recommend, sir, that this week's program?
Well, I haven't read any books about Salvador Dali, but I could recommend two seminal books about the Marx Brothers. There's Joe Adamson's Groucho, Harpo, Chico, and Sometimes Zeppo, which many Marx Brothers fans and authorities say this is probably one of those definitive biographies of the brothers. And also the Marx Brothers scrapbook that Groucho wrote with Richard J. Anobile back in 1974. Some great rare pictures. Some interviews mostly with Groucho in a very salty way, but also with Jack Benny, Gummo Marx, Zeppo Marx, Susan Marx, and Richard J. Anobile back in the early and mid-70s, to us Marx Brothers and film buffs, was like a god, because he produced a lot of terrific books about the movies, including three about the Marx Brothers, including the classic Why a Duck, which sparked interest in the brothers back in the early 70s.
Excellent. So, again, this week's book is
called Giraffes on Horseback Salad by Josh Frank and Manuela Pertega. It's published by Court Books, because it is a quirky book, you have to admit, and it's $34.99.
And how do people find you, Mr. Nolman, should they be searching high and low?
Well, they won't find me in Fredonia, that's for sure. They'll find me in the pages of the Montreal Times every Saturday in print or every Friday digitally. And you can go to the website too, www.mtltimes.ca.
Thank you very much, Stu.
You're welcome. And now I got to find what happened to that elephant in that pair of pajamas.
Okay. Stuart Nolman with another edition of Book Banter here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
The Stuff File.
And we're just about a racetrack for this edition of the Stuff File program. We do have an Idiot of the Day coming up in just a matter of moments here on a show that is also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. And as I just mentioned, boys and girls, it's time now for the Idiot of the Day.
And now it's time for the strange things adults do. This Stuff File presents the Idiot of the Day.
Before we get to the story, regular Stuff File listeners know that in our December year-ender show, we pick one of our idiots of the day and christen that person as the idiot of the year. Now, I know it's only May, and there's more than half a year of idiots to get through, but I'm feeling pretty confident that at the end of the year, this guy is going to be hard to beat. 27-year-old Washington resident Cameron Jeffrey Wilson had a pistol tucked into his front pocket when the gun discharged, sending a bullet through his testicles and into his thigh. Can't think a bad day can get any worse? Oh, wait. We're just starting. Wilson was only beginning to make bad decisions. Instead of heading directly to the hospital, Wilson instructed his girlfriend to first drive to Lincoln Park in Wenatchee, where he gave the pistol to a friend, since he is a 13-time convicted felon and it is illegal for him to possess a firearm. Okay, let's pause here for a moment and do the math, shall we? He's only 27, yet he's been convicted of a felony 13 times. Let's go out on a limb and say he's not a very good criminal. Okay, let's pick up the story. He hands out the gun to a friend in the park, as I mentioned. With that little legal landmine avoided, Wilson finally went to the hospital, where things got much, much worse. As doctors and nurses performed surgery on Wilson at Central Washington Hospital, a balloon containing marijuana slipped out of his anus. Chelan County Sheriff's detectives were notified that Wilson had suffered a gunshot wound and responded to the hospital. They searched the car he arrived in and found a bag of methamphetamine inside a pair of blood-stained jeans he'd taken off before entering the hospital. Detectives didn't arrest Wilson at the hospital, but instead issued an arrest warrant. Like the genius he is, Wilson turned himself in, at which point he was searched. During that search, another balloon of marijuana slipped from his anus. Either he forgot it was up there, or he was planning on smoking it in jail. Either way, this guy has one loose anus. He was arrested and then charged with possession of a controlled substance in a correctional facility, but his legal troubles would continue. From the jail, Wilson made multiple calls to his girlfriend, asking her not to cooperate with investigators. Authorities listened to the calls and subsequently charged him with 4 counts of tampering with a witness. Now, why, oh why, would you keep a gun in your pocket in such a way that it would do damage to Jim and the twins if it went off? Forget you were packing grass where the sun don't shine, not once, but twice, including at the police station, and make incriminating phone calls and tampering with a witness from the jail when any moron would know that all jail phone calls are monitored? One reason, and one reason only, you're an idiot!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program, number 0510. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com, and once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links on all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and once again, that's 0510. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You can also find me on Facebook and Twitter as P.A. Holder. And don't forget to check us out on patreon.com, where you can become a patron of the program. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, GDPR Revolution 99, KDXRadio.com, AirChecker, Canada's number one radio source, PCJ Radio International and its partner stations, TrueTalkRadio.com, downloaded on iTunes, streaming on Stitcher, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, and WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. That's it. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. We leave you with this deep question to ponder. Who did we compare babies to before Winston Churchill?